Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is John Levy, and John is a behavioral scientist, he's an author, and he's the founder of the Influencer's Dinner. More than a decade ago, John founded this dinner as a way to bring together different people, and what it's turned into was a dining experience for industry leaders. He's had Nobel laureates, Olympians, celebrities, and executives all come to his house, cook him dinner, and he does this worldwide as well. And how it works is guests cook dinner together, but they can't discuss their careers or their last names. And once they're seated, they eventually reveal who they are. So it's an interesting way for people to connect. And there are now thousands of members of the influencers community. So we spoke about that. We spoke about how John went to the running of the bulls. And we spoke about his adventurousness and his open-mindedness. I enjoyed this conversation with John tremendously. I was grateful enough to have some of his time, his precious time, while he's doing media for his new book, You're Invited, The Art and Science of Cultivating Influence. And like previously mentioned, because John has spent so much time collecting and finding people from different fields, is he the perfect person to write this book? And what was cool about this conversation as well was it refers back to a time when John didn't have all these traits. And we spoke about 7-8 years ago and what that was like, even getting some recognition from the New York Times, but not actually being in the best place financially. But don't worry about that. You'll get into it, all of it. I appreciate you listening. I appreciate any thoughts at Hey Danny Miranda on Twitter on this episode. Let me know what you think. And until then, this is my conversation with John Levy.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
John, thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure. Are you kidding? Let's have some fun and participate in some shenanigans.
Let's do it. So your first job, I feel like we should start there. You helped your dad out with construction. You're making about 15 shekels an hour working on the childhood home. Yes. What did that experience teach you about life?
Sand is really heavy. I'll be honest, it was so long ago. I can barely remember. But it was... it was really gratifying seeing the results of the work. So when the walls came up and I knew that I was the one that helped make the cement, then it felt like a piece of me was in that. Like I was involved in the creation.
Yeah. And bringing that forward to your current life, how much is creating a book and writing a book similar to the process of building and repairing a house?
Oh, wow. I don't really know how to compare the two, simply because the process of writing a book isn't what makes a book successful. So when you build a house, you're done at a certain point, right? When you, I guess you could say decorating it and all that, it's like for the rest of your life, but when you write a, you don't actually get paid to write a book. You write the book and what you're really paid for is promoting it and making sure it succeeds. Now, the proposal stage takes about like 6 months. You might get like a year to write the book. And then while you're writing the book, you have to start planning pre-sales and media, and all that takes months and months and months. The entire process is much longer than anybody ever thought or thinks. And on top of all of that, I'm going to have to continue now, and I want to, but it's just a lot of work to promote it for the next several months. So I would say that there's a clear endpoint when building a house, there isn't one so much when you're promoting a piece of thought leadership.
What's the most unexpected part about the process of selling a book?
Oh, wow. From the point that you agree on the deal to the point that you actually get a contract takes months and months. And the weird thing is that it's all boilerplate contracts. It's not like they're reinventing something. Book deals have been the same forever, which means that it just seems like kind of probably an antiquated system.
Yeah, that makes sense. Definitely a place for disruption. I'd like to go back to eighth grade for you. In eighth grade, you found out by a series of unfortunate events that you were the person that no one wanted to sit next to. I'm curious how you found that out.
So it's a bit of a long and involved thing, and frankly, it's not that interesting. What is kind of crazy is that I think we were a class of like 16 kids or something like that. I don't remember the exact number. It was so long ago. And the head of our class, the teacher, came in and said, we're going to reassign seating. And each person gets to pick two people they want to sit with and two people they don't. And then she did something kind of wild. She secretly assigned each person a letter. We didn't know who it was. And said, okay, here's the chart. A wants to sit next to B and C, but not next to D and E. And then there was a list. And our job, we played a little game. There was a seating map. And we had to figure out, okay, if I put A here and B next to them, and our job was to make as many people happy as possible. And so everybody did it. And then I realized like there was one person who like nobody wanted to sit with, and it turned out that that was me. So that was pretty disappointing.
When did the comeback story begin? Because today,
I'm hoping it starts any day now.
No, because you are friends with all these people. You obviously host influencers dinners. Like, you are at the center of so many people's lives.
For your
lives.
Listeners, they probably have no concept of my life right now. Unless did you record an intro explaining anything?
Yeah, the intro will be recorded afterwards.
Oh, got it. Okay. Sorry for intro. So first and foremost, everybody wants these moments where like everything turns around in a day, where suddenly, you know, it's this success where you went from zero to hero overnight. And that's not how life works. It's really slow and gradual, and it's day by day, month by month, you chip away at things, you get stronger, you exercise more, the muscle builds. And it's not like we stop being insecure. It's not like we stop thinking, oh my God, I screwed up today, they're going to hate me or something like that. So I'll say a few things. One is I definitely built up confidence in friendships over the years. And probably around 2013, when the New York Times covered us, was when I felt like I was really onto something, right? I had the cover of the style section in the New York Times, which is probably the most prestigious social page you can have in America. Some might argue the world, right? And that story to this day went viral. People still talk about it. And at that point, you know, life was starting to get better. But people shouldn't be fooled for a moment. I think I didn't have much money at the time. I just started earning a bit more, but I was still struggling with all these things. And consistently, my objective was to improve day by day. There's this interesting characteristic of human beings, which is that people say we want to be happy. When I ask you, okay, what's happiness? Nobody can really give me a good explanation. And what it kind of seems to come down to is that when you're really engaged in life, you feel like you have an impact on your own life, some influence over it. And things are on a positive direction, that's when life is great. And so my objective wasn't always to go, you know, have quantum leaps in anything. I just wanted month by month for things to improve. And sometimes things went down and sometimes things went up, but I wanted to keep that trend line, feeling like I was engaged in my life. And so with the dinners, for example, I'd found a way to continuously invite more and more impressive people. With my income, I was, you know, slightly better than broke, but still very much in debt from college. And I kept chipping away at my debts. And that feels great. And so I don't know if there was a moment where life turned around so much as in the attitude that I just want to make progress, because that's what'll make the difference. Because once you get out of debt, you're like, okay, now what? I have no idea what to do. Like, I've been in debt for so long. I have no idea what to do with myself.
But you made it. So,
yeah. And I'll tell you, it wasn't that long ago. Like, it was, I'm 40 years old. It was in my mid-30s when I finally got out from under my college debt.
In researching you for this conversation, it seems like people from your family are successful in, I don't know if that's correct by your estimation, but if it is, how did that make you feel that you were in debt in your mid-30s and you're looking around at your family and everyone seems to have it figured out?
So I think that first and foremost, we need to accept that not everybody's definition of success is the same. So my brother, one of them is a PhD in infectious disease and is an MD, right? Specialist in microbiology, and he runs the Precision Vaccine Center at Harvard. Brilliant, brilliant guy. For him, publishing a lot of papers and getting a lot of funding is markers of success. Raising great kids is markers of success. I don't have any kids. And even though I publish academic papers, I take very little, like it's not something that I care dramatically about. So I am very proud of my brother, but there's no point of comparison. We operate in two different worlds completely. There's no competition. And I might be or have been seen as the black sheep of the family going my own way. And there's definitely been times where I've been super stressed about like making ends meet and covering rent and whatever it is, right? But I continuously feel like I'm running my own race when it comes to my family. I might feel more competitive with other authors or things like that. And, you know, I just found out that I'm number two on the Wall Street Journal yesterday. I found that out. And on most of the list, it's Malcolm Gladwell and then me. And so like, I'm looking at Gladwell and that guy's a legend, right? And I call up my mom and I'm like, by the way, you know, it's Malcolm Gladwell and then me. And she's like, oh, that's amazing. Congratulations. Who's Malcolm Gladwell? So like, I think it's kind of funny that in my mind, within my family, I'm running my own race. Outside, I can't help but compare, but my mom still has no idea who anybody besides her kids are, which is wonderful.
You brought up the New York Times article in 2013 and how that was a really big deal for you. In it, you said, I feel like I've begun to get undeserved status as important, but it's not about me. I tell my assistant, it's all about the guest. There's no space for ego. And I'm curious how you don't get overwhelmed by ego in the face of some of these accomplishments, like getting the number two spot on the Wall Street Journal bestseller list or inviting and having a bunch of important people be at your dinner. How do you not let ego get in the way of that?
So I think there's a few things. The first is that no matter what I accomplish, I'm nowhere near as impressive as the next person at the table. So, you know how they say, if you're the smartest person in the room, you should probably go into a different room or whatever it is. I really try to be the least impressive person in a room. Not because I think what I do is really interesting and I think I'm really proud of myself for what I accomplished. I did not discover statins like the Nobel laureates that are, you know, like these people have saved millions of lives or, you know, some people have represented our country and come home with a medal. And That's an incredible dedication for their life. It's not something that I was skilled enough to do, nor was I drawn to it. And so when somebody has that level of achievement, yeah, I mean, like, what am I going to come in there and be like, I wrote a book. Like, I got you to cook me dinner. They know I got them to cook them dinner. They're there, right? Like, what am I going to brag about? So I think the biggest risk is then just being a name dropper, which I'm probably, guilty of. So, but yeah, when you're really surrounded by people who are extraordinary and you can be really happy for them, as opposed to like bitter, like, why did they get it or whatever, then it changes life. Here's the other thing. Human beings in general, right? So let's say you were earning $100,000 while all of your friends were earning $85,000. You'd feel really good about yourself. If you were earning $200,000 and all of your friends were earning $220,000, you'd feel worse about yourself. So we tend to put things in relative perspective. I'm not in that category. I am in the category of, okay, my friends are millionaires. I don't care about being a billionaire. Maybe they do. But they are definitely going to pull me up on the journey. And so if somebody gets like an amazing contract, I'm like, that's awesome. Because that just means that the more successful they are, the more successful I'm going to be. And all of our friends, we're all just going to keep pulling each other up. But it also really requires that you surround yourself with the kind of people who are generous, caring, compassionate, and willing to be a contribution.
I get a deep sense of self-awareness from hearing you speak. You just mentioned how you think you name drop and you're guilty of that. And I'm curious, where do you think your self-awareness comes from?
You know, I spent a lot of my childhood being a wallflower. It gives you a lot of time to think. And then I'm a scientist. And as a scientist, our basic premise is that we're probably wrong. And that we really want to follow the evidence. And when you take an approach of a scientist and somebody says, you're a jerk, then your response is, no, I'm not. Your response is, okay, what makes you think I'm a jerk? Okay, how should I handle this? What would be better? How could I make people feel more comfortable? Like, I'm fundamentally curious. And of course, my ego gets bruised and my emotions go freaking haywire. But if we can just separate it for a little bit, just so we could listen, and then we can decide if, yeah, you know, that's valid or it's not. I recently wrote an article that went viral, and some of the feedback was, it should never be phrased on any media format, because it's just like people were angry and so on. And a lot was supportive. And then some of it was really constructive. And the stuff that was constructive, I view as an opportunity to expand the model of my understanding of the situation. Right? Because fundamentally, as human beings, we don't have a relationship to reality. What we have is a model for it. And my objective is to improve that model. And much of the model is improving and having a clear perspective on what I do that interacts with the rest of the world.
How do you figure out what exactly is constructive and what is meant to tear you down?
That's a tough question. So I don't think that they're opposing, like, I don't think that's the line. So something could be meant to tear me down that ends up being constructive, right? Something could be intended as constructive that tears me down. So I think that there's a theory called being anti-fragile. Have you ever come across this? So for your listeners, if you take a glass and drop it, it'll shatter. It's fragile. Then there are things that are robust, right? Like you punch your building, your hand's probably going to get hurt, not the building. But then there are things that are anti-fragile, which is things that when you apply pressure to them, get stronger. So you go to the gym, lift some weights. It's hard. It's uncomfortable. But then your muscles grow back stronger. And human beings in general are anti-fragile. You put some pressure on us, we'll actually end up in a better situation, right? We have an awkward moment socially, we learn how to behave better. We do a presentation and we learn from our mistakes, right? So my general view is that for growth, you want to be in that like good zone, right? I don't want to put you on a bench press and give you 500 pounds, it'll crush you. We want to be in that zone where it's uncomfortable, but not so uncomfortable that you're collapsing.
Yeah.
And the constructive zone.
Yeah. And from listening to you and doing research for this conversation, I noticed there are a few concepts and studies you bring up again and again. Mm-hmm. One of them is anti-fragility. Another is the Christakis and Fowler study.
Christakis.
And that's one of my favorite studies as well. I'd love for you to
how about this? I've described it so many times. If you know it well, I'd love to hear how you describe it. Because
yes, of course. Yeah. So for those of you listening, it's you are impacting people four orders of magnitude away from you, in the sense that, and you explain this much better than I do, but the person closest to you or a friend, you have a 45% chance of impacting them on areas like obesity, smoking, lifting weights, voting behavior.
Just to make sure that we share the right data.
Please.
So Christakis and Fowler, these two researchers, were curious about the obesity epidemic. And they were curious, is it the kind of epidemic that's a percentage of the population, like Alzheimer's, right? Loneliness and stuff like that. Or actually, loneliness is probably not a percentage of the population thing, but or is it spread from person to person like a cold? And what they found was startling. So if, Danny, you have a friend who's obese, your chances of obesity increase by 45%. Your friends who've maybe never met this person have a 20% increased chance. And their friends who you don't even know have a 5% increased chance. This kind of effect is true for happiness, marriage and divorce rates, smoking habits, voting habits. Basically, everything passes from person to person. Now, that means that we want to do is really be interested in the people we curate around us. Because if they have habits that we don't like or don't admire, then it could have a negative impact on us. And if they have habits that we really respect, it could have a very strong positive impact. And so that's kind of one of the points of real inspiration for the influencers.
Yeah. And my purpose for bringing that up was because I've heard you describe some of this, the same things over and over on a bunch of different podcasts. And I'm curious how you prepare for speaking.
Oh, interesting. Like when I give a talk or a podcast?
Yeah.
So I don't prepare for podcasts anymore because I don't know what the questions are going to be. So there's no way to prepare. I like to storytell. And what I'll do is I'll go to events that I host, parties, cocktail events, whatever it is. I'll get into a conversation. And I'll literally test out different stories or ideas, see which ones people are most interested in. And each time I tell them, I try to tell them in a slightly different way so that I can see which jokes work, which ones don't. So it's almost like a comedian practicing their routine. And my objective is to explain scientific knowledge in a way that as many people as possible could understand it, so that it doesn't just sit in some like ivory tower of academia, but perpetuates to everybody. And so I put myself through the ringer, essentially, is the answer. And then once I kind of settle on something, it kind of gets stuck. It's why I wanted you to explain it in your words, because I wanted to see maybe there's something I didn't know that I could be saying that could make it even better.
How can scientists better storytell if they don't want to go through the ringer? Or maybe the answer is to go through the ringer.
I think the answer is probably to go through the ringer or spend time with other great storytellers. So, right, if you can tell a story in the same way that somebody else does, then it should be a great story, right? It's a kind of like a recipe for cake or whatever. But I think the benefit is that when you go through that iterative process enough, eventually you can just take anything and within seconds in your head, you form the story and you can tell it. My in the early days, I'd explain too much. I'd give too many facts that I thought were important, and then I'd lose people pretty quick.
Who do you learn storytelling from? Who are the best in the world at it?
Wow, best in the world? I don't even... I mean, Hemingway, like, I don't know, Shakespeare. The best in my life that I get to spend time with is an amazing author, Shane Snow. Shane wrote a book called The Storytelling Edge, and he also wrote two phenomenal other books, Smart Cuts and Dream Teams. And when you read my writing, you'll be like, oh, that's a really great story, interesting concept, super engaging, really useful, servicey. He's the kind of writer that you read and you're like, wow, I'd love this writing, right? And that's the difference between the two of us. I'm a very competent storyteller. He's an artist. I'm a great communicator. He's the kind of person who can create worlds if he wanted to. And so I have a profound respect for him, and people should pick up his books. They're really phenomenal. Storytelling Edge is for story, like how to write and so on. That's a bit of a technical book, but Dream Teams and Smart Cuts are phenomenal.
What does he do in particular that makes him so good?
I think that he treats writing like a craft that you have to be masterful at. So the same way that an Olympic fencer goes and trains, he would actually practice writing. And he'd write, and he'd write, and he'd write, and he'd write when he didn't want to. And then he'd analyze it. And so he treated it in a way that, you know, people are like, I want to be a writer. And then you're like, great, what did you write today? And they're like, what do you mean? Oh, do you want to be a writer? If you told me you wanted to be a professional football player and you weren't exercising every day, and running the basics and practicing, I'd say you're crazy. If you wanted to be a professional musician and you're not practicing several hours a day, then you're crazy. Just because you learned to learned to write letters when you were a child doesn't make you a writer now. You need to practice your craft.
Going back to you, you've said that your superpower is finding patterns. Mm-hmm. So how do you practice, or maybe you don't need to practice, but how would you practice finding patterns?
So I don't think it's something I can help, right?
It's like LeBron James saying, listen, I can't help you be better at basketball, basically.
No, that's a little bit different. That's like a collection of skills, gotcha. Right? So it's everything from weight training to calisthenics to, you know, doing shot after shot after shot, getting to know his team and what their habits are, right? Saying, okay, I'm really good at finding patterns. I think my brain obsesses about them. I don't know if it's like advantageous for most people. The issue is separating causality from coincidence or correlation. Meaning, I'm not sure if you know this, there's an odd characteristic that as the number of churches increase in a city, so do the number of bars. And the question is why? Any thoughts?
Do one have to do with the other?
Well, just more people. Try to guess.
More people.
Yeah. So that would be it, right? So when you say that, people think, oh, going to church causes people to want to drink or whatever it is. But that is a pattern, right? Both go up, but it's not necessarily that one causes the other. There's a third characteristic that causes them both. And so I think if you want to get better, it's first of all, understanding that and separating cause and effect and correlation, because much of the associations we make are either correlated and not causal, or they're not even real. Like we only see the times when things work out. So like, what is it? My friends have like a lucky number and they're like, oh, it's everywhere. Yeah, because you'll notice all the times that you see that number. But if I were to tell you any other number, you'd see all the times that other number appears. So we are really good at finding the things we know to look for and terrible at noticing anything else. Hmm. And here's a simple example. Do you have your phone with you? And nope. Listeners, nope. Could you grab it?
It's outside the room. Sure. Absolutely.
Cool. Okay. So all the people listening, take your phone, put it face down near you. I want you to guess what's the app on the bottom left corner of your screen.
Wow.
Without looking.
Yeah.
Just take a guess. It doesn't matter if you're perfect or anything.
Yeah, I'm going to guess my messages app.
Great. I want you to quickly just pick up your phone and check, right? Just do the thing.
Were you actually right? Safari.
Great. Put your phone down. Now, everybody listening, put your phones down and now close your eyes. What time did it just display on your phone?
11:32.
But but how did you know that? Because nobody pays attention to that. You looked at something else.
Yeah, I'm always paying attention to the time when we're doing these podcasts.
So you had your eyes open.
Eyes open. I didn't find it from the...
Yes. Okay. So you cheated. I told you to close your eyes. You didn't close your eyes. So here's the point. Nobody ever pays attention to the time when they look at their phone. And that's not a flaw of the human brain. It's actually called inattentional blindness. Inattentional blindness states that you will really only focus on what you don't know, what you know to look for. Everything else will be ignored. And the reason that this is important is that if we paid attention to everything, we'd go crazy. There's just too much information coming at us. So in order for us to have like a functional view of the world, we just assume we're paying attention to everything. We pay attention to nothing. And we get to have kind of like this stable view. And that's kind of the problem with finding patterns and making associations, is that when you know to look for something, you'll see it. And when you don't, you ignore it. And so we find a lot of false patterns and think they're true.
How has this positively impacted your life?
One of the important things is that I think it's critical to separate your decision from your results. So you can make a really, really, really bad decision. I'm going to buy a lot of Dogecoin. And then randomly, the market jumps up and nobody really understands why. And you make a ton of money. And then you can make a really good decision. Like, I'm going to sell my Dogecoin or whatever it is, or my, right? And then the market will still go up and you'll feel like an idiot. But you can't evaluate the result from the decision, because you can put the odds in your favor by making a good decision, but that doesn't mean you'll win. It's one of the problems with, let's say, the last presidential election, or the one before that, actually, with Hillary. People think that 54% means 100%. No, it means that if you run something 100 times, 54, it'll go one way, and then 46, it'll go the other. And people really need to wrap their head around this, that they're actually making bets. And if you were to gamble, you want to put the bets in your best odds. But that doesn't mean you're going to win just because the odds are in your favor. And so when I'm looking at patterns, I want to scrutinize them to kind of figure out, okay, was there an actual relationship between these things? If I was going to place a bet, where would I put my money? And that's when better decision-making occurs.
How do you think about the bet to go to Spain in 2013, go to a stadium where a bull is entering and have it crush you? What was the bet there for those of you who...
I want to point out the way that you say it, what sounds like I signed up to be crushed by a bull. And that is just not a fair representation of the story. And you make me sound like a jackass. So for those of you who are listening, let me set this story straight. I, in 2012, had a terrible breakup. And to reward myself for making it through the breakup in such a healthy way, right? Like I stopped drinking, I exercised, like, you know, I did all the things that a human being should when they're going through like an emotional moment. To reward myself, I decided that every month for a year, I would travel over the course of like a weekend to the greatest event in the world, wherever it is, participate, and then go home and go back to work. I had no idea how I was going to pay for it. As I mentioned, I was still in debt at that point. I had a pretty decent job and I was making decent money, but it wasn't like, you know, I couldn't afford anything I wanted. And so for July, I decided I'd go to Pamplona, Spain, and participate in running of the bulls. And I think I made, for a terrible decision, I made the best decisions in the process, right? So I trained in cardio so I could run quickly. I walked the path so I knew exactly what the risks were, where I turn, all that kind of stuff. And when the run came, I made it through and I ran fast enough to make it into the stadium and it was great. But what I didn't know is that there's this thing called the winner effect. And the winner effect is a biological response that I believe mammals in general have. And it works like this. If let's say you get into a fight and you win, your body floods with testosterone, probably a bunch of other hormones, giving you a higher level of confidence. And that actually makes you more likely to win your next fight. But animals in nature that continuously experience this cycle get overconfident and then spend too much time in the open and get hunted, or they get into unnecessary fights and die. It's also arguably one of the reasons for the subprime mortgage fiasco is that people made riskier and riskier bets. They succeeded, and then they got way too risky, and eventually it all collapsed. So I'm in the stadium. I'm on a high now from the run. And a bull comes in, and I see it. I'm like, okay, I'm going to run up to it and touch it. And I did it, and I got away. And so, of course, I had another flood, right? And then I see another bull. And this time I'm like, okay, I got to up at a level. I run behind the bull. I smack it on its butt. And the bull turns to me and looks at me like, boy, you are batshit crazy. And I was in trouble. And fortunately, a drunk Australian guy distracted the bull and I ran away. And so when the bulls enter the stadium, they kind of go up a ramp, two gates are open, and they jump in. And what people do is they lie down and the bull jumps over them. At least that's how it's supposed to go. So I take kind of the safest spot I can. I bend down on the ground. I'm like, this is going to be awesome. It's going to be such a thrill when it jumps over me. And it jumps, slips in the process, and lands squarely on my shoulder, crushing me. And I lose all feeling in my body. And I think I'm paralyzed. I literally, my entire body's numb, time stops. And I'm like, John, you moron, you could spend the rest of your life in a wheelchair. What did you do? And in that moment, my brain responded and said, John, you would have never been happy living a standard life. If we end up in a wheelchair, we'll be fine. We'll figure it out. But you weren't ever going to be happy just sitting behind a desk all the time. And this is a fluke. And I somehow managed to stand up, and I, screaming for like medical support because my body's so messed up. And nobody's paying any attention to me because they're literally dragging bodies of other people out of the way. And somebody signals me eventually and points to triage. And now the pain starts filling in, and it's so overwhelming that by the time I get to triage, I just have enough strength to pass the person my wallet, the nurse, so at least she knows who I am. And I start going unconscious. And she shook me awake, and the doctor comes over and checks out my shoulder and starts rotating it. And I'm in like agony, just absolute agony. And he goes, it's just a contusion. Get out of here. And I'm like, first of all, I was just going unconscious. I'm not going anywhere. Second of all, what's a contusion? He goes, it's a bruise. And I'm like, no, bananas gets bruised. Bananas get bruised. Like, what's going on in my shoulder is not a bruise. This feels unbelievably painful. And he's like, you have, 5 minutes, and then you leave. And then he had to go like take care of some dude that was really like really messed up. There was like five doctors taking care of the guy. And it turned out that my left shoulder was crushed because I was tucked in. My right shoulder couldn't move from the pressure and tore. And then I think I got two herniated discs. And although who knows, maybe I had those before. And I couldn't pick up my suitcases because my shoulders didn't function. So I had wheelchair service at the airports, and they were worried that the impact from the bull pushed air around my lungs, which meant that when I got on the flight the next day, my lungs could collapse midair and I would die. And so I had to eventually go to the emergency room. Some random people kind of pulled me aside and were like, you look kind of messed up. You should go to the emergency room. I was like, okay. And they did x-rays and they said they don't advise flying, but they think I'm okay. And so I got on the plane and I'm still in physical therapy, and it's been 7 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like if you saw my shoulder right now, it's still taped up.
Wow. I didn't mean to make light of the situation.
No. It's totally fine.
Yeah. So another situation, maybe on a more positive note, was you convincing a duty-free sales representative at the Stockholm airport to leave her job and travel with you.
I want to point out, I didn't convince her. And the funny thing is that, and not that I'd be very proud of myself if I did convince her. Me and my best friend, Liam, were going through Stockholm airport duty-free. And it was like, I don't know, 5 something in the morning. And we were picking up some gifts to bring to Israel to meet up with my family. And as we were going to pay, when you go through duty free, you have to give your ticket to show that you're leaving the borders of trade. And so she took the ticket and said, oh, Israel. And frankly, I'd just come from going out. Like I was drunk at the time. And I said, yeah, do you want to come? And she paused for a second and was like, yeah. And I was like, great, then come. She said, well, I'm a graduate student and it's really expensive and I don't think I could do it. And I was, it's like 5 o'clock in the morning. You've been partying all night. I'm like, what if I paid for your ticket? And she's like, okay. So it ended up being like a completely insane thing. She, on her next break, came and met us right as we were about to board our flight. We booked her ticket. 24 hours later, she showed up and my family was like, who is this? but we ended up becoming close friends, and she actually joined our family reunion the following year in Amsterdam. And it was really fun. She's a delightful person. But yeah, here's what's funny. My new book is called You're Invited. And just about anything good that's come from my life has come from an invitation. Now, the new book is mostly about how to connect with people, build trust, create a sense of belonging, because those are the greatest predictors of everything from human longevity to business success. And so that's what my new book is about in comparison to the bull-crushing experiences of my first book.
Well, what follows your life, it feels like from the outside looking in, is just a sense of adventure and openness. If you believe that's true, how do you cultivate those traits?
Wow. So I think that each person has a different kind of tolerance for these things, right? I'm very adventurous, but I wouldn't go like hike the Appalachian Trail by myself, right? So and there's also different types of adventures. There's social adventures. There's like adventuring in nature, right? But the size of our life is really defined by how uncomfortable we're willing to be. Here's an example. I just did a bunch of TV promotion for my book. I tend to hate TV promotion. It's not something I have a lot of experience with. I sweat through my clothes. I'm nervous. Like I'm normally so, like right now, us talking, nothing could faze me, right? Television, on the other hand, I'm like a wreck. But the fact that I'm willing to be uncomfortable is what has me be invited to be on television, right? I could have easily said no and lived a quieter, simpler life. And I think being willing to be uncomfortable is a muscle. And your tolerance for it will define your risk appetite, your success appetite, right? And it starts off with small things. Like, here's a great way to test your discomfort level. How long can you be next to a person without talking? Right. You know that you get that like urge, like you need to breathe because it's an awkward silence. Can you let it last another 2 seconds or do you freak out? Like it's uncomfortable. Can you go and talk to one more stranger? That's super uncomfortable. But that's also how you make amazing friends, or potentially is a way to make amazing friends. So I think you can practice being uncomfortable.
What makes you so uncomfortable about going on television?
I have no practice. I'm not sure if you've ever done TV, but when a lot of the news shows, you put in headphones and then you link through Zoom and you cannot see the person talking to you. You do not know what the feed is like. You don't even see all the other people. So if you're on a panel with like 5 people, you have no idea when they're speaking, what's going on. You're essentially talking into the ether, and often you have to dial in on your phone in order to hear anything. So if they're like even playing play out music, as if like we're telling you your speech is over, you wouldn't hear it in many cases. It's just for the audience. So like you have no idea what's going on, and you have to be on like 20 minutes ahead of time. So you get really psyched up as if you're prepared. And then there's like, okay, now we play the waiting game and you try to like answer emails or something in the meantime, but the entire scenario is uncomfortable because you have no clue what's going on. It's not like I can see you right now and we can have an interaction.
And what types of things do you do to help yourself be more comfortable in that situation?
Oh, wow. So there's a couple of things. Research has shown that if you reposition your nervousness as excitement, so say to yourself, I'm so excited to do this right now, it tends to actually make you more excited and less nervous. You do better. The second is I like to let people know I'm nervous. So there's this impression that if we try to be perfect, right, people will like us more. But I just lean into it. If I was nervous right now, I'd be like, Danny, oh my God, I'm so nervous. This is so exciting for me. I've been looking forward to this. And like, I literally have butterflies in my stomach and I just wanted to say that. Right? And here's what's interesting. People actually find that charming. And because you're opening something called a vulnerability loop, right? If you're willing to express that you're vulnerable, if they ignore it or make fun of it, then obviously trust is reduced. But when they reciprocate, they're matching your vulnerability and you feel safer. And so I try to build vulnerability loops. It's also sometimes called the pratfall effect. When you show that you're imperfect, people actually like you more.
Like spilling a cup of coffee on yourself when you're about to go for an interview.
So I think it's during the interview, you spill a bit of coffee on yourself or you drop some papers. But yeah, that's the famous study.
So you've said on that same topic that you feel like one out of every 10 times you host a dinner, you feel a sense of awkwardness. Could you take us back to one of those experiences?
Oh my God. It's been, it's been a year and a half since I've hosted a dinner. I barely remember what they're like. Something of awkwardness. I don't think I have a great example of it. I can tell you a moment that I intentionally made slightly awkward.
Go for it.
So I have this friend who used to be, and at the time she was a very senior person at Netflix in charge of like content and so on. And she, one of the instructions at the dinners is that if you recognize somebody, please tell me so that I don't pair you off if you know each other, because that way you can meet new people. And she turns to me and says, hey, John, I recognize somebody here. And I go, great, who do you recognize? She says, Sasha. I say, great, how do you recognize her? She says, I interviewed her to be an executive here. I wanted her to run a division of the company or producing shows or whatever it was. I said, cool. So here's what we're going to do. When we sit down to eat and we're playing the guessing game, you're going to be the last one to guess what she does. And she goes, okay. So everybody goes around and Sasha's dressed really very elegantly, very fashionably. People think she's a fashion editor or a designer or something like that. Very petite, very cute. And then it gets to my friend from Netflix and she says, oh, you're this executive and you produce the greatest, this and that and all that. Goes into a whole thing. And Sasha goes, no, that's not what I'm known for. My full name is Sasha Gray and I'm best known as an adult film actress. And my friend was like, oh my God. Definitely not the division of Netflix I was hoping to open. So it's, you get these like funny moments and I wanted that one to really stick out as kind of embarrassing because it was my friend and it's a little playful. But yeah, that kind of stuff rarely if ever happens.
I get the sense that from hosting these dinners, you're like almost playing God in a sense. Because you know all the information.
I don't know who anybody is. I have my team. I don't pick who comes to the dinners. It's handled by a committee. And then I show up and sometimes they'll tell me like, John, be aware this person is a Nobel laureate that's coming. But
oh, wow.
other than that, I'd like to be, to not have a clue. The person from Netflix I was friends with beforehand and Sasha I met at a different dinner party. In fact, when I met Sasha, I didn't know who she was. She said, oh, I'm Sasha. And I was like, oh, cool. And then she explained that she's a DJ. And I'd heard of a DJ by the name of Sasha Digweed. I thought that was her. I later found out Sasha Digweed's like, I don't know, a Dutch dude or something like that. But I like completely didn't have a clue. I didn't recognize her. So that was just one of those off chances. Most of the time I have no clue who anybody is.
When did you make that switch? Because I assume when you first started, you had to pick out people.
Yeah. When I first started, I was the selector. By probably year four, I stopped being involved directly in the selection process. Also because it was year five, it's hard to track these things. And a lot of that is because it's just near impossible to be an expert in everything, right? Like, if you tell me LeBron, sure, I've heard of that guy. If you name any other player in the league, I would have no clue because I don't follow it. I know more about Quidditch than I do about basketball. I don't, tell me, who's a famous astrophysicist? Maybe you could name one. Who's a famous, you know, sound engineer in Hollywood? Well, there's some that have won 4 Academy Awards. Right? That's crazy. They're clearly experts. I just don't know who any of them are.
Yeah.
So
how do you go about
research team?
Yeah. How do you go about picking those people for the research team?
So we set criteria. We say, hey, they either have to be recognized for their thought leadership. I think you wrote a book. You're a professor, an expert in something. Position, right? You're the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. You're probably legit. Or previous success. So if you sold a big company to Google, yeah, you got street cred. You don't have to do anything else. I respect you because the skills that it takes to get to that point don't go away. And so those are kind of the criteria. And then we go, okay, what we did was kind of funny. We went into LinkedIn and copied their entire list of industries. And I said, go search out these industries. Find out what the industry awards. So in architecture, it's the Fisker Award. In acting, it's the Academy, Golden Globe, and, you know, the Emmy, right, for television. And then they'll not only pick those people who win them and are maybe nominated, but also then find people on the most popular shows and the showrunners and the, right? So it's an entire industry around it. It's not just, space isn't just the astronauts. It's who's the head of engineering for SpaceX. That person's probably pretty influential in the aerospace industry.
Yeah. And the research assistants who are actually picking these, how do you pick those research people?
Oh, I have a head of communications and research. I don't get involved.
Gotcha. You're very far off from the process.
I try to be because I don't want people coming to me being like, can I come to a dinner?
That's smart. That's very smart.
And I also like the surprise. Also, listen, sometimes I'll say, hey, team, I'm really into, cybersecurity these days. I'd love to meet more people in cybersecurity. Right. Or I want to get more fit. Can we find the people who run the biggest fitness programs in the country? So we found Barry's Bootcamp and Orange Theory and, you know, all these.
Yeah. So we're just about to enter into a world in which is a post-COVID world, hopefully, where people are able to interact and you're able to host these dinners. What are you most excited about?
Hugs. You know what I might be most excited about? Side conversations. You can't have them on Zoom. And so when I host events, I never get to catch up with people. And so there are certain dynamics that only exist in person. And sending somebody a chat feels weird because there's a permanent record of it. I want to be able to make like a sarcastic comment on like whispered into my friend's ear.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, John, I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate you taking the time. Your new book, You're Invited, available everywhere. Go check it out. John
Number Levy. 2 on the Wall Street Journal bestsellers. Come on.
John Levy, TLB, for those who want to follow him on any social media platform. Thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate you, man.
This has been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for asking interesting questions.
Hope you guys enjoyed that episode with John Levy. I appreciate you so much for listening into the final moments. It means the world to me, and I look forward to seeing you in the next one. Peace.